From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Follow the money, they say. In an American era of widening income inequality, that path goes right to how and where we live. Real estate zoning, snob zoning, says my guest today. Segregation deepening not by race, but by class. One country, not indivisible. This hour On Point, Snob Zones and the New American Segregation. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Do we still rub elbows or move and build walls? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us right now from Fairfield, Connecticut is Lisa Privo, real estate journalist for the New York Times, author of Snob Zones, Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate. Lisa Privo, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Princeton, New Jersey, is Douglas Massey, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. His research focuses on migration, race, housing, education, poverty, stratification. He's author of Categorically Unequal, The American Stratification System. Douglas Massey, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
It's a national issue, but Lisa, you started right in our northeast backyard here looking at snob zoning. What's the focus that you've got here, Lisa?
Well, in covering real estate for a number of years, I became really fascinated by some of the really visceral reactions people had to multifamily housing proposals and affordable housing in particular. And, you know, usually the debates were fairly narrow, so I wanted to kind of dig into that a little bit and find out what was going on. And really, I concluded, you know, that towns aren't the way they are by some fluke of fortune or, you know, the workings of the free market, because what I saw were very deliberate efforts by town after town to keep things a certain way for certain people. And sometimes their efforts were out in the open, and sometimes they were veiled in very official zoning language. But either way, I really felt they needed to be talked about. Because as you mentioned in your intro, you know, we've all sort of just gotten used to things being the way they are.
We're talking very tony towns here in the Northeast, affluent towns often that have, I mean, they might have a 1 acre lot minimums and everything that comes along with that. You say they want to keep certain things the way they are. You know, what way and for what outcome? What are they looking to sustain, maintain?
Well, it depends on the town. I mean, certainly a place like Darien, Connecticut, one of the places I write about, it's always been a members-only kind of place, lots of masters of the universe from Wall Street who are used to being in control, average home price well above $1 million, 4 country clubs. So, of course, they have a certain status to uphold there associated with the Darien address. On the other hand, Millbridge, Maine, a little fishing village in Down East, another place I wrote about. There, it's more of a hard scrabble existence for people. Takes a few jobs to make a living. So when some Latino immigrants started to move in, there was some resentment there that perhaps they were going to take some jobs. So, and there was an attempt to limit housing for them. So it really depends on the place.
In effect, I read you saying these are towns who are zoning to keep the population is very affluent. It tends, at least in this part of the country, tends to be white. You don't have multifamily housing, so you don't have lower income and often racially diverse populations moving in. And the charge you're making is that this boils down to a kind of deliberate fence building by these communities, Lisa.
Yes, in many cases it is. You know, perhaps individuals fighting a project in their own backyard aren't thinking of themselves as being exclusionary. But you know, when this pattern repeats itself over and over again, it does eventually have the same impact as putting up gates around a community. As an affordable housing consultant said to me, you know, he'd been fighting these battles for 40 years, and the debates are still the same.
Lisa Prevost's book is Snob Zones, Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate. Douglas Massey, you're listening here. Is there something new here? I mean, after all, I mean, go all the way back to what the Great Gatsby's in cinemas recently. You've got East Egg and West Egg and the industrial zones, hardscrabble neighborhoods beyond. Is there something new going on, or have Americans always not had communities with some, you know, distance between them?
Well, there have always been rich and poor communities and rich and poor neighborhoods, but this is a real change from the post-war period from 1945 to 1975, which was a great egalitarian period in the United States. Since the 1970s, levels of class segregation, income segregation, have risen quite remarkably, while racial segregation has persisted. Black-white segregation is declining slowly, but Latino segregation is actually rising. So that's the current state of affairs in America.
Is there something illicit here, or is this just what happens when people make money and they look to build some vision of a life that they now have access to because of that money? And here's how they do it. Here's where they end up. Is it, you know, is there something wrong, or just, hey, that's our system?
It's a kind of a racket whereby people with means try to segment themselves off from the rest of the country. They have high property values. They exclude low-income people from living there so they don't have to pay the social costs and force other zones to pay the social costs, but yet they need their labor, so they import them for workers. So they want the labor and they want the workers, but they don't want the people attached to it, and they don't want to pay for the people attached to it.
Lisa, does it make for vibrant communities, for healthy communities economically? There's certainly a lot of money funneling in here if they're masters of the universe headed home from Manhattan. Money must not be an issue.
No. You know, one of the examples in the book is the town of Roxbury, Connecticut, which used to be a very simple kind of farm town. And Arthur Miller discovered it in the 40s and moved in there and wrote Death of a Salesman. But he was followed by a bunch of other famous people. Now we have Graydon Carter, Vanity Fair editor, living there, Dennis Leary, Candace Bushnell. But there's still another side of that town, the locals, who are pretty people of modern means. But because Roxbury is nearly completely zoned for 4 acre minimum lots, meaning
wow,
every house has to have 4 acres of land,
yeah,
at least, there's been a real hollowing out of that community. They're not hurting for money. Certainly the people with the big compounds and big mansions can pay hefty property taxes. But what's happened is they're losing the kind of core base that would, you know, staff the volunteer firefighting force or sit on committees that run the town. And they're also losing children. Their enrollment in their little elementary school is declining. So, you know, it does have an impact on the shape and the vibrancy of your community.
We've got people thinking about this. Sue in Tullahoma, Tennessee is calling in. Hi, Sue. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
I'm your oldest listener.
How old is that, Sue?
I love learning still at top school for 20 years. What I'm concerned about is I grew up in a town of about 20,000, mm-hmm, and my daddy was a doctor. Pharmacists lived next door. The blue-collar workers lived down the street. Woman and man across the street couldn't read or write, and all their children went to college and made all kinds of themselves. And poor people lived over the hill. We all children played together, and we knew each other. And what bothers me, it's so easy now when you don't live with these people, and you live in a gated community, and the poor people live in the projects, to say welfare mom and give derogatory terms to people that you have no clue about what their life is about. And I'd like to know, I may have missed it because I was talking to your person.
Mm-hmm.
When did this start happening? When did we start segregating by money?
So,
in our town, we had rayon plants that the Germans ran. They took it over during the war, but they came and lived in the town, went to school there. My mother bought her clothes at a store where the Jewish lady ran it, and we all knew each other. It was a whole different ballgame.
Sue, I so appreciate your call. Lived together and knew one another across lines, and there's a kind of beauty in that that was celebrated in those decades. When and why did that begin to change, Doug? Professor Massey? Hello, Doug, are you there? Lisa, can you speak to that?
Well, I think it's been a slow process. The suburbs aren't that old. It's suburbanization that has, gradually caused these patterns. As zoning has become more restrictive, there's effectively been a walling out. I do remember, I grew up in New Hampshire, and I remember very well what she's talking about, where, people of all classes lived in the same communities. And that has changed, and it's too bad.
What gets lost when that's lost, Lisa?
Well, as she mentioned, people become less tolerant and less understanding of people who aren't like them, and it reinforces sort of that central fear we all have of the unknown, and that comfort of being around what's familiar. And the longer we live that way, the more it seems, the only way to live.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about snob zones and the new American segregation, maybe, based on class, how two-tiered America is playing out in real estate and where we live. Lisa Privo is with us, author of Snob Zones, Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Douglas Massey is here from Princeton University, professor of sociology and public affairs there, author of Categorically Unequal in New Jersey with us today. Doug Massey, I think we lost you for a minute there, but we had a great caller, Sue from Tennessee, saying, look, she grew up the daughter of the town doctor, and it sounds like in pretty good circumstances, but everybody lived in a stone's throw from everybody else, and they knew one another across these class lines. And her question was, when and why did this really kick in? And if you were saying, well, maybe post the 70s, but what about the decades since then, and what's happened? Is it growing still? Are we headed further into this, or is it leveling off?
Well, it's a simple empirical fact that levels of income segregation have been steadily rising over the past several decades. And you can see this through a lot of different data series. And one of the major reasons for it is the spread of more and more restrictive zoning. And the zoning mechanism that really does it is density zoning. Any regulation that restricts the number of units that can be put per acre of land has the effect of promoting greater class segregation and greater racial segregation, and preventing moves towards integration. And this has happened partly with the rise in income inequality itself. As more and more wealthy people get more and more wealthy, they've separated themselves off and increasingly are living in areas of concentrated wealth. It's also happened as small town America has given way to metropolitan America. And I grew up in a small town, state capital of the state of Washington, Olympia. Mm-hmm. There was only one high school. We all went to the same place. We all interacted together. But increasingly, that is disappearing from the American landscape as smaller towns and smaller suburbs are incorporated into larger metropolitan areas and are differentiating on the basis of race and class.
Even in a place like Olympia, Washington, my uncle used to live there. I remember visiting. It didn't seem like a very segregated town. Is it now?
Well, Olympia had no African Americans when I grew up there. There was one black person in town, and he was a blind guy who tuned the pianos.
Class segregated, your theme.
Class segregation, there were wealthier neighborhoods, but there was only one high school. And I think now there are multiple high schools and there are multiple junior high schools. And since those are arranged geographically according to catchment areas, to the degree that the neighborhoods get segregated, the schools also get segregated and people are separated from one another.
Off we go. Patricia in Stevensville, Montana. Thanks for calling, Patricia. You're on the air. What's your experience?
Hi, Tom. Well, my experience is a little bit different, I guess, because it's the West and we've got a lot of land. But we moved to a valley south of Missoula, Montana, about 20 years ago. And we bought 20 acres and we were surrounded by folks with varying acreage, but all a diverse group of people all around us. And we, loved our neighbors and really were enjoying where we were living. And just to the east of us was kind of an elk preserve of 7,000 acres.
Yeah.
And the community could use it in varying ways. And about 10 years ago, a very, very wealthy family from the East bought that elk preserve and systematically have bought up the property all around us. We are now completely surrounded by it. They now have 12,000 acres. They don't allow anyone to use it. They have no trespassing everywhere. And it has completely changed that section of Stephensville, Montana, to their compound.
Patricia, do you feel like the local peasant now?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't touch them with a 10-foot wall. And, you know, we still live the same way we did 20 years ago. We're humble and modest means. And they have just approached all the neighbors and said, you know, we'll pay your price, whatever it is, and then locked up all of this land.
What's it mean for the community, Patricia? What's it mean?
Well, it means a tremendous thing for the community. For one thing, there was this amazing herd of elk that would travel on this 7,000 acres, and there's a huge meadow that they would come down, like 500 elk would come down every evening, and you could hear them bugling, and everybody in the city, in the little city of Stephensville, would make that a nightly travel to listen and look at the elk. And these folks put up a wall of trees across this this meadow. So not only can you not walk on it, you can't even look anymore at the wildlife.
There's a change in quality of life. I hope you can still hear the bugling of the elk. That's a great phrase.
Well, I can because I'm across the road from it, but I feel a little bit strange living in the midst of this kingdom of people. And it's just the attitude of their attitude of we can do whatever we want because we're the ones with the money.
Patricia, thanks for calling in from Montana. Douglas Massey, let me put that to you in the context of this listener who's listening and commenting on Facebook. Babette writes, this is a different perspective, maybe on the same thing. She writes, there's a natural divide between wealth stations in life. If some can afford to live in exclusive communities due to their wealth, that is their own life circumstance. If I desire to have such wealth, it's up to me, all caps, to change my current life in order to achieve what they have. So on the one hand, here's Patricia surrounded now by 12,000 acres and feeling kind of empeasanted by it. But Babette says, come on, if you want the big thing, go make the money.
Well, it's a very unequal world out there. Not everybody has access to the same resources. Not everybody can go to the same good schools. Not everybody can have the same family connections. Not everybody can have all the preparation they need to go to school. So it's not a real fair race at this point in American society because it's so stratified at this point. And the distance between the top and the bottom of the income distribution has really exploded. So when I was a kid growing up, we used to talk about millionaires. But now millionaires are a dime a dozen, and we're talking about multiple billionaires. And the kind of wealth that has been amassed, allowing billionaires just to buy up and use their economic power to have their own way in neighborhoods like Stephensville, is something that's really we haven't seen since the Gilded Age of the 1890s.
Lisa, you went out and looked at a lot of these towns where this is going on. What's the sense of people living inside what you call snob zones? Do they feel embattled? Do they feel entitled?
Well, when she was talking, it reminded me of the town of Roxbury because there has a rift has opened up between people who want to keep it, you know, very private and exclusive, and people who are kind of missing the community that they remember. And one of the people I talked with who's lived there his whole life said, you know, it used to be that it was the community that mattered and we all pulled together. And now it seems as though it's about the individual. And I think that speaks to a lot of what's happening in society now.
Let's go to David in Lexington, Kentucky. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I live in Lexington, Kentucky, and in a division that has about $400,000, $500,000 houses.
Okay.
And there are college professors, attorneys, doctors. And most of the people have put their money into their houses. And because of the deed restrictions, the deed restriction says that we can have in-ground pools, but we cannot have above-ground pools. And so by our snobbishness, we have had the reverse effect because people cannot afford to have the in-ground pools, and so consequently they can't have the above-ground pools, and so they can't even have real enjoyment of their own property.
So summertime comes, you can't afford the in-ground pool, you can't put the old above-ground pool up there, you just swelter, I guess, David.
Well, we have air conditioners, of course.
Yeah, of course.
But, yes, but it because of the prohibitions, we can't enjoy our land fully.
This is interesting. David, thanks for your call. Lisa, you know, this is part of the argument that's made that this isn't about snobbery. It's about character. We want a certain character to our community, and that requires an acre lot or a four-acre lot or in-ground pools. It's not snobbery. It's just the character we desire, Lisa.
I love that word, character. It's such a useful word. You know, people use it to mask all kinds of things that they don't like. Rural character, historic character. It came up time and time again. But inevitably, you know, the more you talk to people about what they mean, finally you come down to the nub of whatever it is that they're afraid of. And again, returning to the Roxbury example, you know, We're not trying to exclude, said the Zoning Commission. We're not trying to keep anyone out with four-acre zoning. We're just trying to slow down growth. But, you know, inevitably, the Zoning Commission chairman finally said, well, you know, if we had allowed some smaller lots, we're not going to get good guys from our hometown. Families could move in from some place that's not as pristine as Roxbury. And, you know, that is part of it, and that's what we don't often talk about.
Some places are facing suit because of that now, or at least have been in Connecticut. I don't know where that stands today on Section 8 and all the rest up in the Litchfield area. You write about it, Lisa.
Yeah, most of Litchfield County is part subject to this lawsuit charging that they were not allowing Section 8 vouchers to be given to anyone who didn't already live in these towns, and these towns are 95% white, and you know, so the result of that is fairly obvious. But that is still, you know, that lawsuit's pending.
Lisa Prevo, please stand by in Fairfield, Connecticut, and Douglas Massey at Princeton. I want to welcome from Austin, Texas, right now into our conversation, Bill Bishop, contributing editor at the Daily Yonder. It's a web publication about rural America, former writer for the Austin American Statesman, co-author of The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. Bill Bishop, welcome back to One Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hey, Tom.
So we're talking about real estate and class segregation today. A lot of our listeners saying, hey, what's new here? You talk about all kinds of segregation going on in this country. How does the real estate sort of a community line figure into what you see, Bill?
Well, I think Doug and Lisa both have it right. I mean, beginning after the war until the mid-1970s, places were getting increasingly alike in every way you could measure. How people voted, education levels, longevity. And from the mid-70s on, they became different. And here we're talking about at the county level. So every way we could measure, places across the United States are getting different on education levels, on income levels, on how long people lived, on how they voted, suicide rates. Places don't contribute equally to who goes into the Army. So what we're seeing is this increasing self-segregation within the United States across the country.
Among all the ways in which the country then is segregating itself, and we'll talk about why, how prominent is class segregation within that? How instrumental is that in driving the rest?
Well, I mean, class plays a role as Lisa and Douglas have said, but there's another kind of segregation which is by way of life, and so I live in a totally, you know, in Austin is. Has one sort of lifestyle that's high class, and you go to a suburb, it's also high class, and there's a totally different kind of politics and outlook and way of life. So there are a couple of things going on here, too. But I think Lisa was getting at it, and one of your listeners was getting at it, is that as the old ways of defining the self have dissolved, community and family and job, as your listener said, it's now up to me. And up to me means people are choosing the place they want to live to reflect and bolster their sense of themselves.
We talk about ourselves as the country of the rugged individual. Is this new? Is this different? What's the consequence, Bill?
Well, what's new is that people used to come up in communities of descent. You were given your community, your race, your class, your occupation, and now we increasingly live in communities of ascent, places where we choose to live with people who reflect who we think we are, and those choices are constantly changing, and we're constantly, you know, who we are becomes our total preoccupation, and so that intensifies the need to live in a place that reflects us.
Let's go to Jeremy in Evansville, Indiana. Jeremy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to touch on the class division. I mean, I know it's a multi, problem,
mm-hmm.
but, there's a direct correlation just between this distribution of wealth in this country. And, I mean, I believe that's probably one of the main driving forces of it. I'm a union member and have been for nearly 40 years. And you just see it every year, just a little more division. And I'm not sure to say the solution, because, it's many facets, but it's definitely a big problem.
What does it do to your community, to our country, Jeremy?
Well, what I've seen, just like, and I don't want to get into particulars, I went to a rally just a couple of days ago when, a company that's making billions are cutting health and retirement benefits. And I know that maybe I'm leaning off from the problem, but, these people become even more segregated as they fall deeper into their own classes as such.
I appreciate your call, Jeremy. Doug Massey, do we lose an empathy for those outside of our box when the space between gets greater?
Well, it seems so. Increasingly, affluent people are living around other affluent people, and poor people are living around other poor people. And when you look at philanthropy and giving rates, you find that as a percentage of income, the more a person lives in an affluent area of concentrated affluence, the less they give. The more they're surrounded by other rich people, the less sympathy they have for poor people. And when they do give, even though it's a smaller percentage of their incomes, they tend to give it to elite charities like operas and art museums and expensive universities like Princeton.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about snob zones and the new American segregation, maybe based on class, how two-tiered America is playing out in real estate and where we live, how we get to know or interact with one another in this country. Bill Bishop is with us. He's co-author of The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. You can link to his book at our website, onpointradio.org. Lisa Prevost is here. Her new book is Snob Zones, Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate. And Douglas Massey joins us, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. So, Douglas, let me put it to you. Here's Peter. He's writing to us on Twitter. He says, he's kind of slapping his forehead at some of this conversation, says, what do you mean? I don't have the right to live in the countryside? I don't have the right to live where I want? People say, look, I made my money. I want to live this way. Back off.
Well, I think everybody should be able to live where they want to, but the problem is communities erect all kinds of exclusionary barriers. So a lot of people might want to live in Darien, Connecticut, and they would be able to do so if Darien, Connecticut would allow a higher density housing project to be built. But then they erect a barrier saying, oh, no, you can't do that here. Even though there's a developer willing to build and people willing to buy, they say, no, you can't do that. So land markets are not free markets. They're always regulated, and the question is, who are they regulated for, and who do they benefit? And the way it works now is, rich people create land markets that exclude everyone else and preserve a leisured and affluent lifestyle for themselves, but at the expense of everyone else.
But I have to ask once again, if that's different, is it only different because the country's becoming more segregated by class generally? I mean, there's always East Egg and West Egg. There's always been the Tony neighborhood and the less Tony neighborhood.
Well, the thing that the zoning regulations have really spread and become very common. Before the 1970s, there was a lot of discrimination on the basis of race, and as discrimination on the basis of race got outlawed, increasingly communities turned to race-neutral mechanisms to maintain exclusionary zones, such as density zoning. And density zoning has become the big causal driver of segregation in the United States, in addition to racism, which continues to go on. And, of course, density zoning also promotes increasing segregation on the basis of class at the same time.
Lisa Privo, I can well imagine listeners in Darien, Connecticut saying, come on, if you put a bunch of high-density housing in here, this won't be Darien, Connecticut anymore, as we've known it, you know, the community that we love and the reason we moved here.
Sure. But the issue is really towns offering a choice of housing types. This fear of density, as Douglas was saying, you know, this is a big problem, but it's often overblown. And, you know, the town of Easton, Mass., where a developer wanted to build cottage housing, which is very popular in the Pacific Northwest. There are these bright, airy little cottages.
Okay.
They cluster them on a green, and they're usually
cheaper. It's not a public housing tower.
No, and they're usually cheaper than whatever, you know, the four-bedroom colonials in town. But he was met with you know, real fury over this.
Because of the way it would look or because of the riffraff it would bring in?
The density. People could not wrap their arms around the density. They said it would be a trailer park. They said it would be a mini ghetto. They had so many associations with bad density, you know, our failed experiments with density, versus, you know, density that can be very attractive and actually can be a much more efficient use of land.
Let's go to Kristen in Spokane, Washington. Kristen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I just wanted to share my experience, which differs a little bit from others I've heard earlier on the broadcast.
Yeah.
And that is where I grew up in Bakersfield, California, just a middle-class neighborhood where my mom continued to live. Over time, that neighborhood changed to the point where graffiti became common, burglaries, shootings. You couldn't sleep at night because of the cars driving around with their booming radios. To the point where when I had kids, I was not comfortable sending them to grandma's to stay.
Why did it change, Kristen? Why?
Well, it changed, frankly, because of the type of people that moved into that neighborhood. And, you know, I'm just pointing out, you know, I don't know what the answer is, but I think you need to recognize that some people make these moves or you know, perhaps have these exclusionary tendencies out of fear for their protection of property and life, not necessarily snobbery. And that's my point.
I appreciate your call very much, Kristen. Bill Bishop, how about it? Do people just trying to make a life and, you know, taking the steps necessary to make it feel safe? Maybe if we get a bigger chasm between classes, it becomes more dangerous in that chasm.
Well, we're talking around this problem that has real consequences. So if you look at the places where veterans live or where people who go into the Army now live, they don't come from New York City. They don't come from Darien, Connecticut. They don't come from Washington, D.C. They don't come from the places where the decision to go to war is made. And we have 600-700 counties in the United States now where women are living shorter lives than their mothers. And we don't see that. A lot of us don't see that because we don't live next door to it. So the whole idea of a collective nation is being dissolved into these individual choices that we're making about where we live and what we do. And in a sense, there's a good term that I heard recently of soft secession, that states, and I think Lisa describes and Douglas described, places that are seceding from the rest of the country by law by refusing to in Texas to join the Medicaid system that's set up under the new health care law. We're drawing into ourselves and losing any sense of the collective the collectiveness of the nation.
So what do you say to someone like Kristen? She's looking at Bakersfield, California, and her impression, her experience of it is it became less livable, more dangerous, and she was worried about her family. What's she supposed to do?
Well, we don't have a way to have a collective. We only have an individual response to that now, which is to move to a place and hole up. Because the collective responses to that, which is dealing with issues of inequality and development and why this is happening in our society, those avenues no longer work the way they used to.
Let's go to Robert. Sorry,
that's
Bill.
What we do.
Let me bring in Robert from Columbia, South Carolina. Robert, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Well, just two quick points. The class stratification in our military is huge. Who's fighting our wars? Well, it's the poor. It's the lower middle class. They're in the military. They're fighting our wars because they don't have employment where they live. And I also think that our schools, I mean, the money funnels to the wealthy neighborhoods. Look at inner cities. They can't afford high-priced teachers. Look in the rural communities. They can't afford high-priced teachers. They can't get, high-class facilities. But if you look in those neighborhoods, in the rich neighborhoods, you're going to find good teachers, good facilities, good schools. If you look in the rural countryside, you're not going to see that.
There is the danger of a compounding effect here. It's not at all difficult to see, even if we wish people well with their success, how we handle that can have community consequences that are really interesting. Robert, thanks for your call. Sean in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question for both Doug and Lisa and a statement to make.
Yeah.
Basically, I work in a community that's a snob shop. Average income is roughly $120,000 per person.
Okay.
Now, and with being in the service industry, I work in roadside assistance.
Like AAA kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But because of these bedroom communities, they don't want to see this kind of service.
Why?
In other words, they have it, they want it, but they don't want to see it.
What do you mean? They don't want to see the tow truck on their road, or what do you mean?
But yeah, pretty much. They don't want to see the tow truck parked in their town.
Okay.
The town actually hires an outside company rather than most cities have their cars towed within so the residents can get them easily.
Yeah.
This community does not.
Yeah.
Basically, the automotive industry has basically been rounded up and put in one section of town on one road.
Okay.
So it basically is almost, if you're looking for a garage, I guess it would be fairly easy.
So the rest can be a little more like Disneyland. It won't have any oil spots on the road.
Right, exactly. So, but my question is obviously this is a problem. And if we keep neglecting this problem, what do Doug and Lisa suspect is the remedy or what would be the outcome of this?
Yeah, let us pick it up right here, Sean. I appreciate your call. Bill, Doug, Lisa, I mean, this morning, NPR has started this series this week on Latin America, and this morning there was a big piece on crime and how it's become the murder capital region of the world. And, of course, it has even more income inequality than we do here. Now, that's just going to happen in a market economy to a certain point, but it's a kind of object lesson in how you've got to be careful. If it goes too far, it can come back and bite everybody. How does this unfold? Where does this go? Doug, let me come first to you. Douglas Massey.
Well, our market generates a lot of inequality, but so do European markets, but they transfer a lot more of their money for the common good, for public goods.
You mean through public spending, public projects?
Into public spending, into safety nets, into medical care systems, into a more equal society. And so the poor neighborhoods in places in Europe don't come close to equaling a poor neighborhood in the United States. And we've gotten away from any kind of redistributive policies in the United States in the past several decades. And work done by some of my colleagues here in the political science department at Princeton have shown that legislation is increasingly responsive, not to the middle class, not to the poor, not to 90% of Americans, but to the top 10% of Americans. That's who the legislators pay attention to, and that's how the rules of the game are increasingly written.
A lot of Americans look back on a period of redistribution in this country and say, well, there was a lot of ineffectiveness, a lot of inefficiency there. And, you know, you look back on some of those public housing projects, and they hardly look like, you know, a dream.
They're gone. They've been mostly dismantled at this point. I live in the state of New Jersey, which has a doctrine called the Mount Laurel Doctrine, which says that municipalities cannot zone out affordable housing. And I just finished a study of an affordable housing project in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, where the residents were up in arms trying to prevent it, saying it was going to increase taxes, going to raise crime rates, going to lower property values. And when we did the evaluation, we found that none of those things happened. The project went in, 140 families moved in, and because they were able to move from poor urban neighborhoods into to an affluent suburb, their lives improved dramatically. Employment rates increased, wages increased, rates of welfare dependency went down, and the students attending the public schools did much better. So it was a win-win for everyone, despite the huge opposition that met the project at the beginning.
Lisa, Bill, I want to bring the big question to you as well, but a couple more calls. First, Joshua in Arlington, Massachusetts. Josh, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'll be brief. I'm curious about your guest's take on private security forces in gated communities and other private developments. I'm curious about their jurisdiction and what are the rights of people who are not residents when they enter such communities.
Let me hold that one, Josh. I appreciate your call. And one more, John in New Orleans. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Quick question for you, your panel. You're talking, using a lot of examples of the Northeast, which is great. And I live in the South. I live in a growing city and it's
wonderful.
Kind of revitalization of the urban center.
Mm-hmm.
But the initial suburbs, are some of them are starting to decline and people are moving further and further out, which is happening in other communities as well, I assume.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is it better? Would there be an example between what, because of public transportation in the Northeast, between that and large cities in the South and the West, where people are going 30 and 40 and 50 miles outside the urban center? Or
well,
class segregation, just bad or worse?
We'll pick that one up as well. Of course, it's interesting. There's also that movement back into city centers and people of means coming back into city centers. Bill Bishop, look at both of these for a second, if you would. Private security forces coming up in gated communities and the role of transportation and inequality if you get way out into the exurbs.
Yeah, I mean, the theme that pops to my mind is that our problems, we address our problems as individuals now, not as groups. And so we look to solve public issues, public problems, by diddling with how individuals act, and we've lost that ability to react collectively.
Where does it go?
We hire more private police and give up on the idea of public safety. We give tax breaks to individuals and give up on community notions of development or support. It keeps going this way.
I mean,
it keeps going this way.
We want the dynamism of a market economy. We want the dynamism of a healthy community. How do we get those lined up, Bill?
Well, the fact is that getting lots of educated people together, beginning in the mid 1970s, increasingly returned economic rewards to regions. So it became more attractive and better for regional economies to get lots of educated people all in one place. So at that point, you have this increasing split geographically between rich and poor areas, and that's an economic driver, not a social driver.
Lisa Privo, in your research, do you see dynamics unwinding this, taking us back to more shared communities, or the other way, Lisa, at this point?
I think the evidence is pretty clear. It's going the other way. In the town of Bethany, Connecticut, right now there's a proposal to build something called co-housing, which is essentially a little community, in and of itself, where the houses are clustered together, and then they want to farm a good portion of the land and preserve the land that way. But again, people have met that with outrage, saying that this we didn't move to this rural town to be, you know, next to a mini city. Just really no tolerance for any kind of density or new thinking.
Well, this is an interesting snapshot of this country. We're going to have to pay close attention here to make sure we don't all get trapped in those individual bubbles and boundaries that you're writing and talking about, Bill Bishop. I'm grateful to all three of you for being with us this hour. Bill in Austin, Texas, at the Daily Yonder, co-author of The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. Bill, it's great to hear from you again. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Douglas Massey, professor at Princeton University, author of Categorically Unequal. Professor Massey, thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
And Lisa Privo, author of Snob Zones, Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate. Lisa, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, do not miss this hour tomorrow. We'll be talking with superstar food thinker Mark Bittman about his way of eating. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.